Hi, this is Paul. Yesterday, I released a second video, which was sort of a mashup of the conversation with Whole Math and the conversation with Jordan Hall. Because as I was listening to Jordan Hall, certain similarities and certain patterns were sort of holding true between some of Whole Math's story and some of Jordan Hall's story. This video is a continuation of that. As you can see, I like to play. YouTube is for playing, and I continue to play on YouTube. And so I've now accumulated a large amount of personal narrative in the Randall's conversations and the other interviews that I've done. And as I was listening, as I was talking to Jordan Hall yesterday, I was also thinking a lot about my conversation with Andy Wilkins, who had some terrific segments about his growing up years. And so what this video is a compilation of, I start a little bit with Whole Math's early. I didn't pick up as much Whole Math going on. Whole Math's a little younger. That conversation is already out. The Jordan Hall conversation, I think I'm going to release it Monday. So the whole conversation will be Monday. The bits I'm releasing, you'll get a good sense of the bits that are out there. And then the Andy Wilkins conversation is obviously up on the channel. It's been on the channel for quite a while. But it was just interesting listening to the stories growing up. And, you know, a big part of what's happening on YouTube is YouTube is sort of becoming the fractured book of Proverbs for young men. I mean, people are trying to piece together, what are the patterns I need to follow? What are the things I need to see? And what was so interesting about the Jordan Hall and Andy Wilkins conversations is both of them sort of reached the top of their ladder and realized, looking around again in Jordan Hall's language, you know, this is midwits with particular set of skills have reached this level of incompetence. And, you know, you find truly wonderful people on the way up too. But it was just fascinating thinking about all of these conversations as the other conversations unfolded. So I decided I was going to put something together that sort of had it all. So let me know what you think of this little experiment, because I'm really curious as to what you think. This is, of course, now, you know, I never edit, and so this is forays into editing, and it's just the most rudimentary editing that I'm doing. I'm using Bandicoot, which is a super rudimentary but efficient little video editor. And I'll be really interested to see what kind of things. I don't know if I'm going to release this today during the day or if I'll have time to make another video this afternoon. And then the next video I make will be homeroom, and this will be an additional video for today. Just, again, I think YouTube is a great place to play. So let me know what you think in the comment section.
There was one day where everything kind of flipped, and it was, I was always like the smart kid in school, and I had relied on being the smart kid was what was going to get me through life. That's going to get you more rewards faster than everyone else. Mm-hmm. Everybody celebrated me for it and said, you're going to do so great. Mm-hmm. When I was 12 years old, they started, you know, increasing the amount of work. They put me in the AP classes and everything. I was in the advanced math with only five other kids, and it was more work, and I didn't get anything for it. And so I started asking questions. I was like, why am I working harder? Like, I thought I was supposed to be, advanced. Why am I doing more work than everyone else? When do I get time to play and be myself and live a self-directed life? And the adults around me, my parents and teachers particularly, would answer the questions very repetitively and very coldly with a, you know, you got to do this and then you move on to the next thing and then you move on. And I would say, well, but is it going to get better in high school? Is it going to get better in college? And they say, no, you do this until you get to high school, you do high school till you get to college, then you do college till you get a job. And then your job is hard too. And then that's hard until you die. And then everything's hard. And so I had a little bit of a crisis. I remember, you know, hyperventilating and understanding suddenly that the adults around me don't know what's going on, that they're doing what they're told and that I'm doing what I'm told. And I want to live a self-directed life. I want to do things that are important to me and not just follow along. I didn't have a whole lot of, I guess you could say I didn't have a whole lot of respect for just the general beliefs that society holds. Just because people believe something didn't make me respect it or appreciate it or adopt it. And that was something that differentiated me from others around me pretty early in life. So when people told me, do this, do this, do this, I would say, why? What do I get? Where's the demonstration of what I get? And when that didn't materialize for me, when I started asking questions, I sort of turned around against school and church, and I started not doing my homework, and I dropped out of the AP classes, and I would, get the truancy or whatever. I wouldn't show up for school, and I stopped taking the bus even, started riding my bike, and just differentiated myself from the whole thing as much as possible. And it sort of set the stage for a life on the fringes somewhat.
So let's see, there's that. And then somewhere around, I guess I would have been 7, was the first time that I encountered pop culture in a meaningful way. Meaning I was there, the kids were narrating some kind of story. I didn't understand what the story was. Then I discovered that it was the Dukes of Hazzard. So I went home and I asked if I could, watch the Dukes of Hazzard. And then what happened is this triggered my being on the spectrum. FYI, I am on the spectrum. I watched a lot of pop culture. I mean, I really, really just began to die, like absorb it. So I watched, let's say religiously, just to be funny, most television, to be honest, like lots of it.
Religiously isn't funny. That's probably the best word.
Right. And also, but couldn't help also having sort of a meta, right? So
Yes.
watching, but also meta of what's happening and almost beginning this process of noticing things like tropes. Like these days, the notion of trope is a very well understood concept, but I was deducing tropes by absorbing it. But I was absorbing it. I mean, holy cow, the amount of pop culture and then diving in, like comic books and science fiction novels and fantasy novels and lots of TV. Watched most movies between probably 1978 and 1994 or 1992 or something like that. And of course, an almost photographic recollection of their content. And so all of that was going on. And the curiosity was something like both, what is this thing that seems to capture everybody's attention? I remember, fast forwarding a little bit, somewhere around sixth grade, just noticing how much of human attention, in other words, my peers, the people I was around, was driven entirely by pop culture signification. If it's Van Halen, suddenly everybody is talking about Van Halen, and that just seems to be what's going on. And then you'll see like Duran Duran, and everybody's wearing, and it's like, okay, what's happening here? It didn't make sense to me. How do I say it right? It didn't make natural sense to me, but also in order to participate in the culture at all, I had to begin to figure out how to. Wow, that's exactly what it is, actually. That's the deeper piece. This is so I remember reading in all these Reddit forums as the autists began to like really explode out the kind of the autistic, how do we do mating, right? How do we, what's this thing? How do you interact with members?
You have to, you in a sense have to reverse engineer it with your own, in your own frame.
The way I would describe it back is you have to use your superpower to produce a simulator of the thing that comes naturally to, let's say, normies. But that produces a very interesting effect because then as you get better and better at it, you're actually able to do something which is in between those two, which is to notice something's going that's going on in between the cultural artifacts and human behavior that is not noticeable to those who are like very intimately connected with it. And that then, okay, that then branches to the characteristic of increasingly endeavoring to figure out what's going on. How does this work? So this started to look like media theory, political theory, obviously philosophy, notably never religion, for reasons that I suppose are, there's lots of it. That's a whole interesting
That's
thing.
really interesting.
Part of the thread is actually I got very, very attracted to role-playing games, which also happened to be at that moment in a
That's
very
right.
And it fit very well with everything that I was into. And so part of the narrative there is actually having then an awareness of cultural narratives as cultural narratives. Right? That cultivation of something like what I've been calling transcendent mind, part of what happens when you really begin to play role-playing games and begin to be to notice how subcultures operate and begin to notice how culture itself is effectively, at the end of the day, a role-playing game. By the way, you're about to get the game A, game B generator function. That creates a very a powerful step. So the at around 18 or in high school, there was an awareness of a yearning and it felt a sense of mission to find, what was it called? A life worth living, right? So the culture that we had received, the culture that I was living in, on the one hand was not obligatory. That was interesting, and to be aware of the fact that it was not obligatory. And there was nothing in it that oriented you towards value. Like all the characteristics of it were cotton. I called it the cotton candy effect. They were just cotton candy, all different variations on shiny but shallow, in every direction. So then the question was, what does it even mean to be, maybe Peterson's point, what does it mean to be seeking the meaningful? And so that was a meaning crisis moment, but it was a meaning crisis moment, not at the level of spiritual crisis, but actually at just the recognition that either there isn't anything there, right? Life is in fact actually not worth living, or it's just going to be a hero's journey to find it. Right? So that was kind of that period of time.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So you almost didn't go to college.
That's right.
Why?
Well, again, my experience of the category of school was that it was entirely penitentiary. With very limited with some exceptions, like a couple of great teachers who were there that were, I think, important, critical to have a sense of, oh, there's real authority. There's actually human beings who are both wise and caring. Oh, neat. Right. There's like maybe three of those. And then a football coach. So there wasn't, I didn't have an image of that as a thing that was worth doing. I personally have a very profound sense of, again, I hate to keep cursing, but sort of a fuck you sensibility. So yeah. I wasn't going to do it just cause. And I'd almost failed out of high school. So it was plausible that I wasn't going to get in anyway, even if I wanted to. As it turns out, a combination of, I could do very well on standardized tests. And so I did very well on the SAT. And also I'm a legacy at Texas A&M, like probably 40-ish people in my family have gone there several generations back. And so that combination, I got into Texas A&M. So, and then I visited and they made a very good pitch. They said, well, you're going to be invited into the Honors College and you're going to be on full scholarship and your scholarship pays for room, board, education, and anything above that, we're just going to write you a check. Pizza and beer money is literally what they called it. So I was like, that's a pretty good deal. And basically I get to live for 4 years and, hang out. That's not too bad. So I did that.
That's not a bad deal. Even if you're a little shaky about college, it's kind of, what am I going to do next? I might as well do that.
So then what was interesting was that I noticed that though, that I had chosen to do that. It was no longer penitentiary. I could do other, and I could leave at any time. So then I had a quandary, which was, and by the way, from a lineage perspective, honor plays a profound role in my sense of values. To be honorable, I had to actually fully commit. Okay. So that was like a 180 degree flip from my previous school experience. In college, I was all participating participating in what was available and endeavoring to use it for what was it presented itself to be used for. And so I started with a variety of different subjects, political theory, economics, computer science, and ultimately ended up landing in philosophy, because when I reached the boundary conditions of any particular discipline by asking questions, when the professor said, well, we don't actually ask those questions, I said, well, who does? And so I guess that would be philosophy. So I eventually just sort of finding my way more and more in philosophy, because I just wanted to ask the deeper and deeper, more profound questions. That was the one discipline where people appreciated that as opposed to got it. And of course, at the end of the day, it's actually pretty easy to map the intrinsics of any particular higher level discipline. Economics once you get the axiomatics, it all sort of flows. I mean, there's turning the crank is not trivial, but understanding what it's about is straightforward. Computer science is, as it turns out, deeper, but in any event, And could always do the polymath thing. So I could always just, like, for example, when I was at the tail end of high school, there's a thing, I think it still exists, called the AP test, placement test. And what I discovered is that while I was not in any AP classes, I discovered that that actually wasn't an obligation.
You
You
can
could
take
just
the
take
test
that.
anywhere.
So I was like, well, that's fine. So I signed up for, I think, 8 or 10 tests, just, read the book, and then passed all the tests. And so I was actually able to pass the first year of college, which turned out to be very sweet because I had a 4-year scholarship and I only had 3 years of school. And so my fourth year, this is, you're going to get a lot of insight into my character. I dropped a class that was required to graduate. Therefore, I had to come back for my fourth year to take that class. To get my scholarship, I had to take a minimum number of actual classes, which meant that I got to take a lot of really cool classes. I took one class called Outdoor Adventure Programming, which was a combination of like orienteering and ropes courses. That was awesome. 2 semesters of that. I also took 2 semesters of Greek, which is really,
Really?
why did I do that? I have no idea why, but I did, and it was great. I loved it.
Oh,
And
interesting.
I read about the first half of John in Greek. Which was like my only exposure to the entire Christian corpus for, I guess 50 years.
It's not a bad selection. It's not a
No,
bad
I loved it.
selection.
Great. Yeah, really, I've had and still have a significant connection to John. Yeah, so then we get to that point where somewhere in the sophomore, which in this case would be my second year of college, began to have this awareness of, obviously, that the we were be just beginning to move into the earliest stages of what would become known as the internet, meaning networking was beginning to happen. Like computers were connected to local area networks. The earliest dial-up services were beginning to happen. So, okay, the Microsoft thing had happened, the Apple thing had happened, the sense of that there's a wave, that wave, it moves fast, it moves big. And oh my gosh, as I'm now exposed to a large population of people, I notice almost none of them have any idea of what's going on, and yet I do. So that's a thing that I'm going to play. So I combined a, how would you call it, obsessive study of media theory. I could, philosophy, psychology, whatever the components happen to be, communications theory, information theory, like literally everything that can be studied in books over here. And how do you actually participate in it at a practical level? Like, how do you actually engage in this practice? And so FYI, just to kind of like simplify, come to my last year, which is this bonus year, my thesis was I needed to climb a higher mountain to look around because my horizon was actually still quite limited. I had access to what I could get access to via media, which was quite poor. I had the exposure of a country boy who grew up in a small town in Texas, and then I had the exposure of Texas A&M, and I unfortunately, the guidance counselors were not sort of designed to guide the kind of thing I was trying to do. So that was
No,
not.
no, no.
And so I deduced, I think somewhat well, again, a very limited possibility, that going to an elite law school seemed to be the path of least resistance. Because again, like the SAT, you really only have the LSAT. You couldn't get into grad school or business school or any of those schools without a lot. But getting into law school, you just had to really do well on one test. So it's low cost. Just take the test, see if you do well, and then see what happens. And so I did. And I didn't really know what elite meant. Like, I didn't know that Stanford mattered at all, really. And I didn't know that Harvard mattered because there was a couple of movies where Harvard was mentioned. It was clearly important. And so I went to Harvard. That's it. Like, it's as simple as that. As a way of getting like a higher perspective and getting like some form of credential that would give me access to the next set of steps. So it's a very sort of strategic slash tactical move.
Boy, this is so interesting for me because I had no, I mean, because when you talk, you don't know what's in people's past, and you don't know how people become who they are. So this is fascinating. So then you go to law school. I mean, it's interesting. So you actually got a degree in philosophy. That was the degree that you got. So then you went to, so then what, so what did you figure out about the world by going to law school?
Well, okay, so let's do slice that two ways. It's 3 years, and it was Harvard Law School, so I was actually at Harvard, which mattered more than law school for the most part.
So for my to-be daughter-in-law who has a law degree from Yale, Harvard is number two. You know, well, everyone at Yale wants to say that. So
it could be. Well, I actually got into both Harvard and Yale, and I chose. But you know why?
Because you heard about it in movies.
Because it and also when I went there, Boston's a lot more interesting than New Haven.
Than New Haven, Connecticut. That's true.
And I knew no more, right? No, nothing more, zero. And I had no intention of ever being a lawyer, so that part was irrelevant. The fact that Harvard sort of is more in the direction of being a corporate lawyer or business lawyer, and Yale's more about being an academic. Like if I had known that, I might have gone to Yale, but I didn't, and ultimately didn't care.
Yeah.
Beautifully, after my first year, I had a conversation with the dean and effectively got permission to take a very small number of law classes for my second and third year, and ended up taking classes all over the place. I took, anthropology class, a graduate level anthropology class, a graduate level mathematics class. I took some classes at the business school, at the Kennedy School. I even took a class at MIT. I'm not sure how that worked out, like how that worked. But in any event, I got much more of an exposure to that. I got an exposure to the people who came to the law school. So now I get to get this mapping in an embodied sense. Like I didn't like have a model of Princeton. I met people who went to Princeton. Oh, okay. That's the aristocrats go to Princeton. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Kind of smart people go to Stanford. It was clear. Stanford, yeah. They're definitely smart. There's no question. Yale is smart in a slightly different zone and a little bit more airy. Like, okay. And I sampled that. That was useful. And also there was something like, I can play at this level. But there was nothing about that level that was even the least. It was actually weirdly similar to the previous eras where it didn't take long to figure out how to just sort of like do the things necessary to get the highest level and without a lot of work. So I actually also had a full-time job while I was at law school because I had to pay for it.
So physiology and psychology, what was your first real adult career job then out of university and how did that come about?
I was a musician as well. So my first attempt at a job was I formed a rock band while I was at university, and I had dreams of being a mega rock star. See, I was dreaming big even from the get-go. So we formed a band. We used to play at university. We used to play in the bar. We get free drinks. So it wasn't a sort of a lucrative career. It was if you wanted a drink, of course. But then after university, I thought, no, I love this. There's something about writing your music and playing and performing in front of others. And if they appreciate it, there's a buzz about that was addictive. And I thought, wow, yes. Let me try and do this. So for about 18 months, we were doing gigs around the country, trying to write more songs, get a deal. Alas, it didn't happen, and the dream slowly died. We were clinging on to it, hoping that one more gig and luck would change, and then boom, a sudden collapse into like, we got no money. This isn't going to happen. The dream has to die, and this painful realization that that dream of mega stardom and influencing the world through your music was just not going to happen. And it probably heralded the most difficult time in my life. But when I look back at it, probably the most formative one, where I was living in London, in a shared accommodation with a bunch of others who were also struggling, we were told when the band decided to call it a day that we had 1 week to get out of this property. And I was absolutely clean out of money. My father, I love him to bits, but he was quite a strong disciplinarian, and the idea of me trying to do this was something that he thought was absolutely ridiculous and stupid, and why would I waste my life on doing something like this, and why don't I get a proper job? And I had a little bit too much pride to go crawling back to Yorkshire with on my hands and knees saying, "You're so right, Dad." So I was faced like, what the hell do I do? And it precluded, well, it caused the most difficult phase of my life. I ended up out on the street with my guitar and a black plastic bag of bin liner of some clothes. And I ended up in a squat with sleeping on the floorboards with other people in the squat who were like doing drugs and losing themselves. And there I was with my guitar, my bag of clothes, wondering what the hell just happened.
Sounds like the prodigal son. Went to the far off country, squandered what your father had given you, and here you are with a black plastic bag and a guitar with the drug addicts and homeless.
Exactly. It was, when looking back, one of the most incredibly formative periods, because it was a time where, you know, I'd wander out into the streets, and if you did meet people, they'd say, well, who are you? Like, what do you do? You know, where do you come from? Where do you work? What? I don't have anything. I don't have a job. I don't have money. I don't. And this, like, I have nothing. This, it felt like the whole world was going on out there, and I was kind of cut off from it, really cut off, like existentially cut off, and didn't know how to connect with the world. I didn't even have money to get even a basic suit to go to an interview. I was just left in the sort of t-shirt and jeans that I had. And I remember, you know, there's that sort of expression from forget the philosopher now, Nietzsche, that you, when I was there sort of lying on the floor late at night, and it was all dark and you could hear the drug addicts going off on one, this sort of sense of, who the hell am I? Am I really a nothing? Is this what it's come to? Am I a nothing? And it was that sort of staring into the abyss. Have the abyss stare deeply back into you, that cold dread that maybe I was also going to fall into this abyss. You could hear other people in the other room. I have some drugs, Andy. No. I can't do it. And it caused me to go through a period of existential kind of fear. I really thought, maybe I'm going to lose myself here, that, you know, I have nothing to hold on to.
Yep.
It forced me to look really deeply into myself and say, who am I? What have I got about myself that I can hold on to as something that I could reflect on as, you know, okay, I'm reasonably intelligent. I'm physically well. I can. So I had to reconstruct myself to have something to hold on to. To take me through that period, because I thought I was going to sort of collapse into the abyss, recognizing the things I need to improve, but things that I could hold on to. So when I faced the world, I had something to hold on to take me through that journey. And it was, when I look back, probably one of the most formative periods of my life, because I see so many people who haven't had to look deeply into themselves and see, who am I? What have I got? Who am I for myself? And then find themselves defining themselves by their job or the things they've got, and which would be fine if things are going well. But if those things disappear, there's a kind of existential collapse, because I don't know who I am. And it's helped me a lot, I think, looking back, going through that process, because, yeah, people, there are more knocks that you'll have along the way. But if you've been there and you've come through it, you can pretty much come through anything. I'm sure there are things that will knock me over in the future, but it's given me a kind of greater, deeper resilience that I think had been really helpful. Now, I wouldn't wish this on anyone. One of my best friends at the time also went through a very similar process, and he ended up committing suicide. So it's not.
Yeah. This is not a formula.
It's not a formula, but in the sense of facing the deepest adversity that you can handle, and coming through it, there's a kind of fortitude and strength that you get from being sort of forged in that furnace that can be really powerful and helpful for your own psyche as you move forward into life.
And so basically what you do with this skill that you have basically figured out these systems, and you have also figured out, unlike the penitentiary process of grade and high school, you have figured out that you can actually ride these other systems and they will take you where you want to go, even if these other systems are ostensibly pointing in other directions. It doesn't matter to you. You're riding them to achieve maybe even something that you can't fully articulate yet.
Right. That's right.
But you have a sense that you are going in a direction and you are riding these systems.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I would say that I wouldn't want to overemphasize something like high accuracy.
Right.
each of these particular choices was in a fog of war, and something like 80% of the energy put into it was a waste of time. And oftentimes a confusion that had to be unwound. But there's something like an increasing orientation towards a ridgeline of less and less. So, for example, when I got out of law school, by the way, I was married this whole time. I got married last year of college. We're culturally Texan. And so we get married young. We ended up moving out to California because I was able to notice that the tech thing was in California, but I wasn't able to discriminate where in California. So we landed in San Diego, which turned out to be, let's say, wrong, but, you know, maybe perfect.
The beautiful wrong.
Yeah, beautiful wrong. And not being caught up fully in the vortex of Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
He actually had been to my benefit.
Yeah.
But had no legibility in how to participate in the actual startup game. Like,
yeah.
Little, zero. Like, I had no idea what was actually part of it.
Yeah.
And had no business experience at all. And so I was a lawyer for 3 months. At a law firm, like I got hired at a law firm, was able to quickly determine that that wasn't, how do I say it right? It wasn't even a life worth even endeavoring to live for a little while. Quit, became an investment banker for 3 months, because that was up gradient. The investment bankers they're clearly up from the lawyers in what's happening. And I could get there. I could make the step from one to the next. I couldn't make it all the way to being the business person. And I didn't want to be in business, like a business person, but I want to be an entrepreneur, and I didn't have any exposure to that. But the investment bankers told me they did. So I went there. That's obviously a terrible thing. So I got out of that quickly. Then spent a full year in a place of authentic authority. A gentleman named Bill Otterson identified me, spied me, and said, okay, here's the deal. I'm going to pay you effectively nothing, and you're going to work for me for a year. But I'm going to introduce you to entrepreneurship and the entrepreneur.
Yeah. The pay will be the network.
The pay will be the network. And something like the experience of getting to know something about this.
Yeah.
Which was great. I mean, I'm tremendously grateful to him. And he passed away not too long later. Real fondness for him and everything he was about.
But what happened next? This is what we want to know. I mean, you're homeless, you're having this prodigal son moment, and
well, I realized I wasn't going to get out of this situation unless I found some way of getting some money. Because I needed at least a suit to go to an interview. I didn't even have that. So it was a moment very difficult for the ego. It's like I didn't know what to do, where to turn to. So I ended up walking out onto the streets and basically banging on doors, asking if anyone would hire me for anything. It was that kind of desperate.
Yeah.
And eventually came across people doing some sort of building work, sort of small renovations and things. And they looked very surprised that I... basically asking for work, but they did actually need a laborer. So they said, okay, we'll hire you in, cash in hand, you know, very poor wage. But it was with a bunch of Cockney builders. Now, for those of you not familiar, Cockneys are a name for people based in London who've got a very sort of working class London accent. You've probably seen them on films, etc. But your accent is really, really important in the UK. There's still, like, people position you, as you've mentioned on many of your podcasts, you can position people down to the sort of nearest 10 or 20 miles from with your accent. So I obviously wasn't from London, and I had, immediately they clocked on that, what do they call me, college boy. Like, wow, we've got college boy here. I bet his wrists are a bit limp. And so I was hired, and I was absolutely taken to task by these Cockney builders. Like, what the hell have we got with a college boy here? Like, there's no way he's going to be able to do anything. But I thought, no, I'm going to show you. So I got there early. I worked really, really hard. And week by week, this college boy ain't too bad, actually. He's all right, this college boy. And so I did about sort of 8 to 10 weeks there. And the guy who ran the crew, he was sort of in his early 30s, and he wasn't having this. He said, "No, you're a college boy. You're like, I don't believe that you're as good as you think you are, or as hard as you think you are." So he said to me, "I want you, if you're really like you are what you everyone's saying you are, I want you to come down the boxing gym and do a couple of rounds with me. I want to see what you're made of, Andy." So I had to go down to a boxing gym and get in the ring with this guy who was about sort of 10 years older and like half as big again as me, and slug it out for a couple of rounds. I got my head kicked in, but I didn't go down, and I thought, "I'm going to show you." And by the end of it, he came up and gave me a hug and said, "No, you're all right, Andy. You're all right." So it was a weird experience of baptism of fire that was an amazing experience of me of having sort of experienced prejudice against the college boy, yeah, and then yeah, having to stand my ground and do what I needed to do to prove that I am worthy of their respect. And in the end, they became good friends. But through that experience, after about 3 months, I'd earned enough money to get to buy a really cheap suit. And then I was still like, I don't know what I'm going to do. So I went to a job center and they said, "Well, we've got these kind of clerical roles that going that, you know, college boy, you might be able to do one of those." A couple of them didn't really work out, but I ended up at British Telecom, BT. And I got a job there as a clerical assistant, which is basically sort of carrying memos around and doing photocopying. I was sort of like the bottom of the bottom. And I thought, right, okay, I'm gonna, as much as I did in the building site, I thought, right, I'm gonna give it my best. And I worked really, really hard. And 10 years later, I was running one of the divisions in that.
Oh my! Part.
So then start getting involved in startup companies. The very first one was MP3.com back in 1998, I suppose.
Wow. So when you were thinking about what kinds of startup companies you felt were worthy of your time and attention, what were the kinds of things you were looking for?
Well, the most fundamental was, okay, all right, interesting. So I have to break it up into two different buckets, because the buckets were actually completely different. Over here is tactical. Right? So I knew that I needed to just learn how to do this thing. So I needed opportunities that would give me the maximum exposure to the stuff so that I could go up the learning curve as fast as possible. So that means, generally speaking, companies that will be doing, they have big aspirations, but they're shooting big, they're playing in the big leagues. And also, for whatever reason, I can somehow have an intimacy. I can get involved and be able to kind of get exposure to a lot of it. Mm-hmm. In that case, the particulars didn't matter that much. Mm-hmm. And so at the time, there were two. One was in a certain kind of biotech. And the other one was MP3 in media. And of course, then strategically, back to McLuhan, it needed to be in the internet, and it needed to be something in the category of media. Mm-hmm. And so what I noticed when I sort of did my analysis, music, well, I didn't care about music at all. Mm-hmm. And knew nothing about the industry or anything about it, seemed to be the thing that was ripe at that moment, right? So it was going to hit, the way it was going to hit, it was going to hit, I was actually doing this research, it was going to hit in about a year. And roughly 6 months into that year, I came across the folks that were starting this company, MP3.com, and joined. And so that was the arc. And so I was able to join very early, like right in the beginning. Yeah. Beginning of it, so get a vastly outsized participation, like
yeah,
thousand times outsized participation. I was a VP. I was hired as a VP. exactly zero business experience. Yeah. Even to the point that I didn't even know what a spreadsheet was. You need to understand, like, I didn't even know what a spreadsheet was.
Wow,
I'd never run one, and I was like, so what do? You open up Excel and you start playing with it, and of course,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Complex spreadsheets. At the end of the day, it's not that hard. Yeah. Scary a little bit, because there's a fear of like, wait a minute, am I going to fail? But as it turns out, it's craziness. And so you can get a lot. And I should mention, by the way, just kind of like do a ligature of the moment. While I am beginning, like I'm going to the office and working really hard, one of the more senior people says, you know, we got to go to the movie theater like right now and go watch a movie called The Matrix. I think you're going to like it. So this is when The Matrix comes out 25 years ago.
Yeah. And The Matrix was like this revelation that happens in the culture, like whoosh.
Whoosh. Yeah. Because it hit it at the moment that you're talking about, like this movement when the analog hits the digital, and the digital is you can tell that it's something profound. You can tell that the level of disruption is not the same order as the previous kinds of disruptions, both in terms of speed and magnitude and how do you call it? Intimacy or detail. So let's see, what did I learn? So one thing I learned was that maybe not entirely correctly, but this isn't as hard as it looks. Okay. So the senior people who I'm meeting, I'm like, wow, they're kind of like dysfunctional and crazy. And yet we're going, like we're knocking things out. So people who are less dysfunctional and crazy might actually be able to be more effective, which is powerful. Like as a 20 something, you know, 26, 27 year old, a feeling of permission to say, hey, I could do this. I could do this as well as they're doing it. Why not? Okay. Second, I actually remember very clearly being in the room with the head of one of the major labels. I think the US division of one of the major labels. And noticing, how do you say, let me see if I can say it right. the glass-eyed look on the face of a dinosaur that has not realized that the meteor is already hit. That's it. Right. So nothing I could say or do was going to do anything. I was endeavoring to actually help this individual. Like, how do I help you take advantage, notice what this is doing so that, you know, what your world will be, not a chance.
No,
they're already dead. No. It's just, it'll take some time to play out.
Yeah.
Okay. But here's the next thing. And I learned a lot, tons and tons and tons about the actual, how do these kinds of waves unfold over time? How does it go from what would be sort of a Percian firstness through its developmental stages, from what I used to call it, like the guys in t-shirts with pizza stains, to the sweater vests, these are the VCs, to the guys with Lambos or private jets. Like there's an arc that it follows. And I've watched that happen now like 8 or 10 times. And so there's a pattern. And that was important. It was embodied. I was in it, in the middle of it and noticing it, but again, watching it.
Yep.
The third, and this plays a big role in kind of the next major phase of my life, was how the pieces of our social infrastructure are connected. And this is what I mean specifically. We disrupted music entirely, except music was ultimately connected to law and politics in a way that doesn't obviously make sense. In a way that, say, for example, pottery isn't, right? Music is actually not ultimately an economic function. It's a political and legal function. And so as the technological piece, we were utterly, their business model was dead, their distribution model was dead, their production model was dead. Like it was clear that we had already won the war. And in a matter of single digit years, everybody would be pivoting to what we were doing, except they had the ability to control judges and politicians,
Yeah.
In a fashion that was not predictable from a naive perspective. In other words, naively, we had the law, we were not violating the law. But in fact, the way the law works is it's what the judges say. And if you own the judge, then guess what? You win.
Yeah.
Okay. Important. There's a verticality to the stack of this game. And the core is where the actual important stuff lives. So if you're going to be doing anything in the periphery, always notice where and how it's connected to the deeper core, and either be able to not poke the core, or know how to get to the core and separate it out, carve it out. So that was a very profound lesson, which I learned again in my third company.
So you're playing in that, and so where does the story go from here?
Well, let's do the recursion on the Harvard experience. So get forward. So I do the entrepreneurship thing a couple of times, and am now like skilled at it, good at it. I'm accomplished as a CEO and founder of tech companies. And both experienced and have relationships and reputation.
Yep.
And I have enough money that I actually have fuck you money. Hey, neat. Yep. And so I say fuck you and I retire. And for the most part, then my life kind of splits into, at this point, two pieces. One piece is Family Man. right? I actually am just taking my kids to school, which was beautiful. One of the best periods of my life was just taking my kids, hanging out with my kids and taking them to school.
Yeah.
I wish I had been homeschooling, but I have neither the competence nor the, at that point, the concept of that. So I took them to school, which is a terrible thing, but in any event. And a return to that story of higher horizons. Right? So in just the same way that I had climbed from small town Texas boy to Harvard to take a look around, I now might find myself invited into elite institutions and, you know, elites, you know, billionaires and Nobel Prize winners and heads of state and what would be the other one? Captains of industry. And so I did, you know, went to various places. I was now flying private jets from black tie parties in New York City to trustee meetings in Santa Fe or wherever it happens to be. Private islands, not Epstein's. Never, fortunately. And interestingly enough, I think I have insight into how that happens, which is to say you're not dropped into Epstein's island at T0.
Right.
Kind of invited to through progressions.
Right. Right.
You kind of
There's
a hierarchy. And wherever you stop is sort of where you stop.
Right.
And so I stopped pretty quickly because it turns out I wasn't interested in almost any of that. Like, it just wasn't my vibe.
Yeah.
Other people who I know, I suspect, went deeper. And and therefore, by the way, became more powerful.
Yeah. It's what did you learn on your way up about, let's call it the modern world? Because you saw, I mean, if you work in the trades, that's very much a culture. I mean, I worked in a lumber yard loading trucks. And, you know, it was great work. My father growing up worked on farms. And, you know, I very much think young men should work with their bodies, especially when they're young, especially while they've got that health and youth. And you just learn a ton working and living in much more of a blue collar. And then you get into, you know, you get into a British Telecom, I would imagine, is this massive institution. What did you learn? What did you learn on your way up there, especially in terms of from your path?
Well, anyone who's worked in corporate America or in a big organization like this will recognize that these organizations have lots of hierarchy, and that which was very much more the case in those days as well. There was all the managers were suited blue or black suits with shirts and ties, and the hierarchical status was very, very prominent. So you had to sort of cow down to your superiors. You obeyed their orders pretty much without question, and you were happy. You were just grateful to have a job. But there was a sense that if I applied myself and knuckled down and did what I was told, there was a possibility for a career. This could, you know, be my career for life, and I'd be patient and invest time and do my work well, and maybe I'll get promoted, and then I could establish myself. So I entered this sort of very hierarchical organization, and my approach, which I think helped me, and looking back on it, was a useful one, and it's one that is a mentality that I've carried beyond and that's transcended my work there. I was always thinking, like, what is happening here? What's the situation that's arising within our department? What is my boss going to do? Like, if I was my boss, what would I do in this situation? So I used to do my task, but thinking about what would I do if I was the boss? Then I would watch what the boss did and think, why did they do that? Ah, okay. So I was almost rehearsing to be the boss before I was the boss.
Interesting.
And that helped me, because when I was given promotions, I could slip into a role more quickly and more easily. It's almost like I've been rehearsing to do this, and then I'd be working the same at the next level and the next level. But it did teach me that there were ways you could apply yourself to help you move up the escalator a little bit more quickly, rather than just finding yourself in a job and sort of panicking for the next 3 or 4 months of how you're going to do it. But it was very hierarchical and power driven. And as you move up the hierarchy within a large institution, when you start at the bottom, you're doing with real work and real people and real products, real customers. And then somewhere at the top, you have the levers of power. You can sort of make things happen. But in this middle tier, it's like the shark infested waters of middle management, which don't do the real work, nor do they have the real power, but they sort of mediate between the two. And there's a lot of signaling and making sure that you look good and hitting the numbers, and some very psychopathic type behaviors can come out in that middle shark infested waters. Everyone's clambering and scrambling to make their way up the greasy pole. And it's when I entered those waters that I really thought, I can't do this corporate stuff. I was too interested in what needed to be true out there for customers and what we're building. I wanted to do the best that I could with the life force that I've got to have the best impacts that I could. And this sort of playing politics to screw people over and playing games, yeah. I can't do this. And even when I was running a department there, I was still technically middle management because my department wasn't making $100 million that even registered on the radar. So there came a point where I just thought, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this. And I literally told my boss, like, shove your job. I can't play this game anymore. And I just like, sod it, I'm off. Because it was a situation that I just couldn't confront anymore. And off I went. Into a wholly different direction.
Oh, well, let's hear. What direction and why?
Well, I got to the point when I was running the messaging business in BT, and it was around about 2000, and messaging and telecoms were quite big. There were, you know, the dot-com boom, and telcos were a big player in that. And so there was lots of interest in all these new funky services that were coming out on mobile networks. So I got invited, because BT was seen as a big player, to go and present at a number of international conferences. And for me, this was like, oh my God, this is amazing. So I even came over to San Francisco to present on a panel. That was my big first international conference. And I remember sitting on a panel, and there was the guy running Microsoft Exchange for Microsoft, the guy running messaging for AOL, and someone else from Nortel. And it was me. And I was like, holy shit.
On the stage with someone from AOL.
Yes. Oh my God, I've surpassed myself. But I remember giving my talk with my knees, basically giving a round of applause underneath the lectern, because they were trembling so much at being in this sort of esteemed crowd. But it went well, and that sort of gave me a confidence I could do this. So given that I was doing these kind of presentations, it came to the attention of one of the big international consultancy companies, Arthur D. Little, ADL.
I've heard the name, yeah.
Yeah, they're like a smaller version of a McKinsey's or something like that. They as soon as they knew I was available, they said, Andy, would you come and work for us? Because we're doing some big major telco deals, and your experience and knowledge is going to be really important, because all this fancy, new, clever, internet-y stuff on networks is kind of where all the action is, and we need an expert in our team. So I got hired into there, and before I knew it, I was being parachuted into boardrooms where people would be hanging on my every word. And I thought this was amazing. Like, a couple of months before, I couldn't get my boss to take me seriously. And now people are throwing money at this consultancy company to just hear me pontificate on stuff. And I thought, my God, this is amazing. But it did give me a couple of years experience of like how the big boys make decisions about mergers and acquisitions. How would we do that? And I made, again, some fantastic friends there, which I've got today. And it was great experience of being in the boardroom, which I always thought, well, this is interesting. I always thought that merit must be at play here. And those, therefore, people right at the top must be so planet brain-like to have made it all the way up there. They must kind of know everything. And one of the greatest sort of so surprises for me was the degree of to which that wasn't the case. Let's be polite. There were a lot of people there who were pretty darn clueless. They could certainly have a turn of phrase and sound all sort of competent, but really they didn't understand much at all. A lot of it was gloss, and that shocked me, that the people running most of our organizations are dumber than I thought they were.
Yeah. Yeah. They had acquired a particular set of skills, but that set of skills was tended to be what was practiced in that environment. But because you have no real experience in it. And again, this is sort of the culture of normies down below that just say, well, we have governments and doctors and scientists and things, and they'll make sure the machine continues to run correctly. And I think especially in, go ahead.
So like, for example, how do most conspiracies work? And the word conspiracy is nice because it just basically means like breathing together.
Right.
And for most of them, like 90% of them, they work like this. I'll give you two examples. I happen to have arrived early to an event in Aspen. So I was sitting at a table and some other folks who had arrived early were there. One of them was a CEO had recently sold his company. One was sort of a McKinsey guy in charge of something. Another was a banker guy. And they began talking about telecom. I'm not kidding you. In a space of an hour, they had come up with a plan for this new CEO to become the CEO of a company that they were going to create and fund for the purposes of buying multi-billion dollar telecom assets from British Telecom, Spanish Telefonica, and Deutsche Telekom to form into a new company. And we're talking about in the order of billions of dollars. And these three guys, over a span of about an hour, sketched out that plan, and I discovered ultimately executed on it. So that's, and if you think about it, it's just from our point of view that from our point of view that feels insane. But if you just take the scale down, this is like the equivalent of putting together a fishing trip.
Yeah,
it's just they happen for them, and that's just not out of the ordinary. To us, it's like holy smokes. To them, it's like we happen to play with Lego blocks that are this size, and we put them together in just the same way that you play with Lego blocks. It's just our blocks bigger.
Yep. No.
Okay, so I have other examples of that sort, but you get it. So then. Second is that, again, and they're not that impressive.
Yeah.
People who are running things that I met, again, in terms of the skills, a very successful politician is quite charming. No question. Right. But other than that, like once you're like, okay, and what else? Oh, not much at the end of the day. Okay. You know, a brilliant academic is really brilliant at what they do, but generally speaking, not that impressive. And generally speaking, actually not even like, other than having a lot more exposure to the domain.
Yeah.
Not, there are geniuses, and don't get me wrong, they're geniuses. And I met several and they're amazing, and oftentimes really weird and difficult to deal with. But not that impressive. Like there was no sort of sense of, okay, there's an actual qualitative distinction here. It's just that midwit meme is very much to the point. They're highly motivated, reasonably adequately amoral midwits, oftentimes with relationships. And by midwit, I mean like, let's call it 120 somewhere. Three, I discovered these stages. And you're invited into different levels. And there's places at which one of the key elements, by the way, and I'm certain on this, is you are a key element, like the ticket, the price of entry is coming out of integrity with yourself. Mm. You are invited into something which somehow in your heart or in your, what is that called? Conscience is wrong. But I can get access to this really interesting thing that I think I want, power, money, opportunity, whatever it happens to be. Do I make that move? And so that's like, that's the real price of admission. Mm-hmm. And if you make that move, then you actually get the thing, right? But at the cost of coming out of integrity with yourself. And then of course, now the question is how much further can you go? And so I know that, like, I know that's part of it because I was invited many different ways into that kind of a choice. And for a variety of reasons, very little of which had to do with my own virtue, didn't. What was the fourth? Okay, so then the fourth. Now we're bridging into the meta crisis side of things. This all happened to happen in the timeframe of 2008 to 2010. So as the financial crisis hit, and then as it spread into the global financial crisis, what I noticed was that there was no there. And what I mean is this. What the official story on MSNBC or through the president's, you know, the politicians,
yep,
was definitely not the story that the people who actually were in charge were saying in private.
Yep.
So there was absolute separation between those two. But the people in private didn't know what the fuck was going on either.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're terrified. And we're in many cases, honestly concerned that they had seriously fucked up.
Yeah.
Oh, I accidentally broke the entire world. Like, yeah, this is an experience.
Yeah.
But we're not either willing or able to undergo an adequate level of insight to be able to actually be equal to what was happening.
Mm.
And that was very frustrating and demoralizing, because my orientation was kind of like, hey guys, this is like a fire brigade.
Yeah.
Let's do this thing. And that's going to require that we actually think deeply about what's happening so we can respond to it properly.
Yeah.
And either because at the end of the day, there's self-interest. I'm the head of a global bank. I don't want that to go away. Like, the right answer might be, yeah, let all the global banks go. That might be the exact thing that's best, the best thing to happen here.
Yeah.
Oh, well, now that you say that, no, we're not doing that.
Right.
Not
unlike some of the music industry when MP3 hit.
Yeah. Quite exactly the same. And then the other one is, the problem is that when you're ultimately a very high functioning midwit, if what actually is called for is something that is fundamentally a deeper level of consideration, it's just not going to land on you, right? So those two forces conspire to a very powerful driver in history, I'll let you know. And so then that left me in this place of investigation. But as I've told this story many times, I then just started pulling at that thread, saying, I wonder what would happen if I started talking to people who were... Are you frozen?
No. No, okay. I'm listening. I am frozen, but I'm frozen. I'm wrapped with attention. So keep going.
I just noticed that because of where I was having conversations with people who were domain experts in a wide variety of completely different domains. Like, this guy over here happens to be the world's expert in the amphibians in local waterways.
Yeah.
And he's like, hey, by the way, there's an absolute crisis going on here because concentrations of estrogen and other kinds of heavy metals are disrupting the endocrine systems, and amphibians are no longer, they're becoming neuter. They can't reproduce.
Right. Right.
And we may see a collapse of the entire, you know, entire species.
Right.
Oh, okay. Neat. Nobody else knows that. Like, you and three other people, it doesn't seem to be propagating out.
Right.
Except Alex Jones, who's getting it through some kind of weird schizophrenic read. Then have a conversation with the guys, like, again, it is a small group, four or five people who are largely like the experts on nuclear nonproliferation in the entire world.
Yeah.
And they say, yeah, there's no way this regime holds together. Like, between 5 and 20 years from now, there is going to be a massive proliferation of nuclear bombs, and therefore nuclear powers or nuclear weapons are going to start going off. Like, we're going to have a nuclear weapon go off in a major city in this time frame.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's super interesting and scary. And it doesn't seem like that information is propagating out into the broader field. And so I just kept pulling up those threads while continuing to do a super deep dive into money and economics, because that was the first one. So this then leads me to the meta crisis.